from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The trial over the deadly 2016 ghost ship fire in East Oakland kicked off this week. Families sobbed on the first day as the names of the 36 victims were read. And yesterday, the defense blamed arsonists, possibly wielding Molotov cocktails, for the fire. We'll get the latest. And then at 10:30, Amazon, GM, Delta, Halliburton, IBM, those and 55 other Fortune 500 companies paid zero income taxes in 2018, according to a recent report. And we'll talk about the laws and policies that enable corporate tax dodging. It's all next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Lawyers began presenting opening arguments in the ghost ship fire criminal trial in downtown Oakland on Tuesday, and defendants Derek Almena and Max Harris are on trial for 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter stemming from a 2016 fire at the ghost ship warehouse, an illegally converted artist collective and residence in Oakland. Families wept as the names of the 36 victims were read. The defense blamed arsonists for the fire, and here's Almena's attorney, Tony Serra, outside the courtroom yesterday.
We strongly believe it was arson. You know, we have witnesses to support that. And I told them that there was, you know, one witness close by heard popping sounds, like glass breaking, right before the fire. And then he saw people run out the back door. And that suggests that Molotov cocktails, or at least bottles with gasoline, were utilized in the arson.
Joining us to discuss the trial here in studio is David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Michael.
And we also have Sam Lefebvre with us, KQED art staff writer who attended the trial. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks, Michael.
And let me begin, Sam, with you. You were there. This was pretty emotional, what we just heard.
Yes, absolutely. The prosecution's opening statement in particular was very emotional. You had the picture and names of each of the victims there in court, and you had the prosecutor, Casey Bates, really walking us through the very last minutes of many of these people's lives in the warehouse that night.
He's the assistant DA for Alameda.
Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, he, you know, basically a lot of the witnesses he's going to call, they were there that night. They were, you know, escaping this building. A lot of them weren't sure they were going to make it. A lot of them lost friends. And so, yeah, that definitely elicited a lot of sobs in the courtroom.
He also said that they died because no notice, no time, no exits.
That's right. The prosecution is really saying that Derek Almena, built this place into a fire trap with a sort of brazen indifference to the safety of its residents and partygoers. And they're saying that Max Harris, as his sort of second in command, also shares the blame there, that he enabled it, that he went along with it.
And Max Harris's defense attorney has been trying to pretty much separate the two of them, right?
Yeah, it seems like there's maybe a little bit of tension between the attorneys on that point. Harris's attorney could certainly maybe throw Almena under the bus a little bit, and he hasn't done that. But they're saying, Harris' attorney is saying, look, my client didn't have any real power in this place. He's being called the creative director. That was a joke. He was more like a janitor. Harris' attorney kept calling him a servant.
There's all this argument about hierarchy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, so both of the attorneys are saying, the media and the prosecution is going to tell you Almena was like a despot or a tyrant or that he reigned over this place. But the defense are going, no, this was a sort of lateral or non-hierarchical organization where things were run collectively and it was, decisions were made in sort of an egalitarian spirit. And I think we can really expect the prosecution to push back against that.
David Levine, we heard that cut from Tony Serra. He is trying to build a case, and I think both defense attorneys are clearly trying to build a case that says, well, whatever may have been in the way of violation of codes or anything along those lines, the cause of the fire still is unknown. It was arson.
Sure, but under the California instructions, if you are a substantial factor in causing great bodily injury or death, you can still be responsible. So I think that the way the prosecution can handle that is saying, look, that a fire was foreseeable, or at least a reasonable person would know that a fire was foreseeable, and the fact that it may or may not have happened in some, sounds to me like a pretty bizarre way, is of no legal merit because you can be a substantial factor.
What about the fact that defense is arguing, and we'll talk about the judge's response to this, maybe Sam can enlighten us on that, but not using terms like fire trap or tinderbox or death trap?
Right. Well, the judge has tried to limit the language on the other side, saying, at least in the openings, that the defense lawyers couldn't use the word scapegoat. So the judge has been trying to keep control, knowing that this is a trial that could easily spin out of control.
And the judge will not be convening today because the judge has jury duty. Is that right, Sam?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Trial's back in session on Monday, but not today.
We're talking, by the way, with David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of Law, and Sam Lefebvre, KQED art staff writer, who had attended the trial. And I know there are many of you who have questions about, well, the trial, about the legality, about questions about what's up ahead. We have, as I said in my introduction, about how many charges? We're talking about 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Correct.
Is that right, Dan?
36 yeah. People died, 36 counts.
So a charge for all of each one who died.
Right.
You listeners may want to jump in here. Let me give you an opportunity to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org, or simply go to our website, kqed.org/forum. There's a different narrative here that's unfolding, David Levine. So If they bring this narrative in, it has to do with an auto shop and a feud and supposed Molotov cocktails, these things along this line. What will it do for the defense?
Well, what they're trying to do is to say we are not culpable. Again, I have trouble because of the idea that there's a that could be a substantial factor, could still make you be responsible. But I think overall, the issue is what the defense is trying to do is to say, look, these defendants did not act in a way that was so reckless, was so indifferent to human life. So to me, what's very powerful for the defense is the idea that police officers, firefighters were around and nobody ever cited them. Nobody ever told them this is dangerous. You've got to clean this up, that kind of thing. Now, there's a counter narrative to that. But the idea that if they didn't know, how can we be expected to know how dangerous this was if professionals who saw it had no idea that it was dangerous?
So the defense is bringing in not only arson, it's bringing in the fact that there were professionals who came there, the city is to blame, in other words, and perhaps even the owners are to blame as well.
Right. Everybody else is to blame. That's the idea that Harris and Almena should be considered the least culpable. And in particular, what they want to do is to say, since the law requires criminal negligence, that you can say in hindsight, maybe they acted unreasonably, but not so unreasonably, so recklessly, that they should be found liable for criminal negligence, i.e. involuntary manslaughter.
Well, in fact, Tony Serra was trying to paint a picture of these being aesthetic young men and dedicated to the arts and all of that sort of thing. I'm just wondering how this is going to go and whether it's going to really have any force behind it. At the same time, we've got all these people who have died and people who want justice for their deaths.
It's horrible. It's just horrible. I was at one of the funerals. It's horrible. But nothing is going to bring those people back. Nothing will bring them back. But there are people who feel that that will bring them closure. Now, remember that the guilty pleas were thrown out in large measure.
I was just going to get to that. Yeah, please, go ahead.
Sure. But Almena was willing to plead to 9 years and Harris to 6 years. But the trial judge, a different trial judge than has the case now, threw it out in part, I think, because family members indicated that it was not adequate punishment.
That was part of it. The other part of it was they felt the judge said Meldon showed no remorse. Or
absolutely.
Not
right.
So that was a big part of it as well.
Yep.
What do you see from the defendants from your point of view, Sam?
Well, there's definitely this sort of fight over the character of the defendants going on. Both of their attorneys are calling these people sort of consummate 100% artists who are motivated by trying to create this sort of, utopic arts community. Tony Serra likened Ghost Ship to the Louvre or to a museum, this sort of repository for all of Almena's, you know, collections from his world travels. Meanwhile, the prosecution is going, no, Almina was motivated by basically greed and power. He wanted to, you know, basically hustle these tenants by subleasing space to them.
Plus, wasn't there a construction worker that figures into all this? I mean,
absolutely.
He warned Almena, right?
Absolutely. So the prosecution is saying Almena, when he first rented this place, he hit up a friend who was also a construction worker. And this friend was like, yeah, you can make this place safe. It might cost you about $8,000 to $10,000. And Almena went, no, we can do it better, cheaper. And then he turned around and he hired basically an unlicensed contractor to do a lot of this initial work.
Again, we're talking about the Ghost Ship Warehouse fire criminal trial, which has begun. And if you want to weigh in here, and if you have some thoughts or questions, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Jake wants to know, did the Oakland Fire Department ever inspect this building? I believe the answer is no.
Well, that's a big point of contention in the trial because, you know, Sarah is, in his opening statement, said that a fire inspector, Maria Sabatini, actually did come inside the warehouse to inspect it, although she denies it, and he intends to bring witnesses who saw her there. And the way he, you know, previewed these witnesses' testimony was she went inside, she took a close look around, and she actually liked the place. He said in his opening statement that she crossed herself in front of one of Almena's statues of the Virgin Mary.
There are also a lot of lawsuits that are thrown into this. David, let me go to you on this. I mean, even PG&E has been brought into the picture.
Sure. On the civil side, the standards are going to be very different. The standard of proof will be quite different. And so that it's easier to imagine liability being more widespread on the civil side. So, for example, should PG&E have realized that power was being booted into this building, that sort of thing? Should they have inspected at some point? So I think there are greater shots at civil liability. The landlords, I think, are part of that as well.
But also, I mean, let's just deconstruct this a little bit. There was flammable material that was stuffed from the floor to the ceiling. I mean, that's pretty much part of the record now. And we're talking about highly flammable things. I mean, furniture, art, and other objects. It made it difficult to find the exits, and there were no signs for those exits. So there's real culpability there, isn't there?
Well, a jury could certainly find that, let's say. Also, remember, almost everybody who died was up on the second floor. They were there for a party. By and large, the residents, I think it was one resident died, somebody who had a broken leg or broken ankle, he couldn't get out. But all the residents who kind of were more familiar with the space were able to get out because they were on the ground floor. The people upstairs, there was, I think, one rickety, totally illegal staircase and no other exits, and they all died upstairs. So even if you thought that the art space was borderline acceptable, the idea that you're going to jam people upstairs in a party was really, I think a jury could easily find that was reckless.
And Sam, these witnesses that Tony Sarah's talking about, they were not at the hearing?
No. Some witnesses were at sort of preliminary hearings for scheduling items, but not the—
I'm talking the witnesses who said that they heard people talking about torching the place, that sort of—
So the defense has three witnesses that they say are going to testify to support this arson theory. Two of them were residents of the building, and the third is sort of totally unrelated to the building, and it was someone who was driving by. And earlier in the preliminary hearing, they actually issued a witness warrant for that third witness. So it seems like the defense hasn't actually been able to locate her, and she seems like a pretty crucial witness for the story they're telling.
Tweet from Kimberly. Let me go to you in this, Professor Levine. Kimberly says, are the jurors being sequestered, and what if they are listening right now and hearing from us what the judge has told the attorneys they cannot say in front of them?
I don't think that they are sequestered. However, they certainly are under strict admonitions from the judge that they are to pay no attention to any news that's related to this. They shouldn't be reading the newspaper. They certainly, as much as I know you want big ratings, they should not be listening to the show or anything else related to it. They shouldn't be traveling near the ghost ship, that sort of thing. They should stay away from it. And we hope that that's the case.
And you're going to add something, Sam? Yeah.
And in fact, there was some sort of procedural drama yesterday in court where one of the jurors was actually removed for, you know, improperly communicating with someone else.
The judge wouldn't say what that was all about.
That's right? About all we know. Yeah. So
she also apparently refused a hardship case to a juror want to be removed, and she said no.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
Well, let me get to some calls, and let's get to Kevin as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. The first thing I want to do is just express sympathy for all the survivors and the friends and family of survivors. What you're all going through is horrifying, and it's hard to hear, and it's hard to hear, you know, of course, that the first trial didn't happen, didn't resolve this, and that this happened in 2016. My question is, why is the landlord not on trial? Why is the landlord not in the defense dock for taking their money and not making sure that the building that he is renting out was safe?
Yeah, Kevin, thank you for the question. David Levine, you want to comment on that?
Well, we don't know exactly why. That's a prosecutorial decision. And you have to assume that the prosecutors did not think that they were going to be able to demonstrate that the landlords had enough actual knowledge to meet the standard of criminal negligence. Again, for civil purposes, the standards are lower and the landlords may well be liable for damages. But the criminal side, evidently the prosecutors just didn't feel that they could go ahead.
Let me thank that caller. And here's a question from a listener tweeting, do initial witness reports substantiate arson claims, or is this attorney coaching? Popping sounds are more likely circuits frying than motiveless homicide by Molotov cocktails. Seriously, survivors don't deserve these antics.
So people who've watched this closely have been very surprised by the arson theory being advanced by the defense. Two of the witnesses expected to support the arson theory, you know, are known to media. They've done interviews. And as far as I can tell, they've never said, you know, oh, by the way, I think someone might have been throwing Molotov cocktails. So that was a big surprise this week.
And Tony Serra was talking again about a feud between somebody who was doing electrical work.
There were sort of allusions from both defense attorneys towards to a feud between the proprietor of the neighboring business, Omar, who ran an auto shop, and Almena, or people at the warehouse. But that was something that was really only alluded to in the opening statements.
I want to read another comment from a listener named Kim who says, I am all for the arts and creative communities, but looking at the photos of the inside space, it was like an indoor Burning Man. Fire departments are usually able to find the source of arson, even if there was arson. If there were exit signs, staircases, sprinklers, and any other safety measures, there would not have been 36 deaths. This was a disaster waiting to happen, and it did. And we'll go to another caller, and let's welcome Al. You're on the air. AJ,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I just wanted to say, so I have been to the ghost ship on two prior occasions before the fire. And let me tell you, my experience just walking in there, it was a disaster waiting to happen. And anyone in there, right? You know, it was cluttered. It was a lot of wood. It was just a matter of time before it was going up. I believe that culpability should be expanded, to include. Now, do I believe that Mr. Harris, is culpable. I think it's a little excessive. But the city is just as culpable, as well as the fire department, as they are, for neglecting their responsibility and their job, just as he had neglected his responsibility. I think that's only fair. I knew one of the victims, who I worked with, mental health industry, and she was who had introduced me to that scene.
Yeah, you're cutting in and out, AJ, unfortunately, but let me thank you for the call. Maybe we can get a better connection, although we got just a little time left here with Sam Lefebvre and David Levine. And Sam, let me go to you. What are the victims' families saying? What are you hearing from them?
Well, some of them were in the courtroom, and they were very clearly moved by the 911 calls that the
sobbing a lot of
that the prosecution played during the opening statements. There's that they're on a quest for justice, and I don't think there's a consensus about what that looks like for the family members of these 36 people. Just as they're really doesn't seem to be a consensus in the broader sort of music community about, do we like what's happening? Is this the kind of, is this going to make us feel better? There's no consensus about that.
Here's Bryce, who writes, in discussions of this tragic fire and the lead-up to the trial, one factor that seems to be continuously missed is the press coverage. KTVU continues to show what might be the most unflattering photos of the two defendants. How does this influence reactions of jurors? David Levine.
Well, again, once they are jurors, they shouldn't be watching any news coverage. We hope that that's the case, that they are obeying those judges' instructions. And in terms of selecting jurors, one of the things that you look for is to figure out whether the jurors had been closely watching the coverage previously, whether they had made up their minds or whether they could set that aside if they knew anything about it, and in this case, they probably did.
But all they have to do is look at a newspaper, you know, go past the newspaper stand and see. They are very unflattering photographs of both defendants, I must say.
Sure. I mean, that happens. Jurors, I mean, we hope that they're going to avert their eyes. They're not going to look. We hope. Now, look at the kind of things that they're going to have to see. In comparison to the the photographs that were shown of these 36 people who died, in comparison to the forensic evidence that they are going to be seeing, an unflattering photo that they might have glanced at in the newspaper, I think, pales in comparison.
Let me bring another caller on with us, and that's you, Lori. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. First of all, I really want to thank you for having shows like this because I hope that it prevents future catastrophes. There's a little feedback, so I apologize on my phone, but I used to run an alternative art gallery. I had numerous possibilities for making more money, having more raging parties, for people liking me more. And I happened to have PTSD from childhood, and I couldn't sleep at night thinking that if I broke fire laws, put too many people in there, allowed candles, allowed people to cover lights with cloth. And, you know, I was sort of accused of being, you know, a tight ass that didn't want to have fun. And when I heard that this happened, I was like, I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often.
All right. I thank you for that, Lori. Ominous remark. And we hope it doesn't happen again, obviously. And one of the artists who actually died in the fire was a musician named Chelsea Faith Dolan. She performed in Bay Area's underground electronic music scene under the stage name Cherushi. And we're going to go out with a song from her recent album, released posthumously, a collaboration with musician Maria Minerva. But first, Sam, tell us about her, can you?
Chelsea Faith Dolan, San Francisco DJ and sort of house music artist. She was affiliated with the label 100% Silk, like Golden Donna, who was supposed to play that night. And yeah, she was one of many truly fantastic artists who died that night. You know, there was also Joey Cassio, well-known to the electronic music community, Johnny Egaz, who DJed as Knacked, Barrett Clark, who was a crucial sound person for lots of parties, and Chelsea Faith Dolan.
Thank you, Sam LaFave. Thank you, David Levine.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up tomorrow on Forum with Mina Kim, philanthropist and former Microsoft executive Melinda Gates joins us to talk about her new book, The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. And as KQED's Youth Takeover series continues, we'll talk with teens about efforts to crack down on cell phone use in schools. To listen to past shows and join the discussion, visit kqed.org/forum. And for the latest updates on our programs and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum.